Now, you were talking about some of the problems as it relates to the fitment trials, fire suppression, avgas, and the hangar facilities. Would you have been working closely with Lieutenant Ken Gibbs, who was on this with Staff Officer Air at Halifax during that time period?
Well, yeah, we'd be. They were in touch, and we were keeping them briefed and that sort of thing. But again, our effort, if there was a problem, they would go through the staff line and probably tell us unofficially, and go through the staff line to headquarters and then come back down to us. We had to take a direction from one person, or one director.
One directorate. I see. What sort of other concerns would have VX-10 had as it related to the fitment trials? You had talked earlier about your fixed-wing aviation experience and your landing signal officer experience. So when you're looking at Assiniboine and she's just come out from the West Coast with the flight deck fitted and the hangar conversion completed, what were some of VX-10's concerns?
Well, we had a fairly major concern in this area, and one was the LSO, as we call them, to give four directions to the helicopter. And we were very concerned on the location of this person and the facilities he had for control. And there was another concern I had in that the bridge in the destroyer was isolated from this area, and in those days, of course, no television to tell you what was going on there, and no easy way of looking behind you and seeing. You might see a helicopter hovering, but you don't know what's happening on the deck when it is secured, when it is ready to turn out a wind or whatever might be the case.
Right.
Communications and control. So I can recall saying that we had to have a control system for the LSO to the bridge, vice versa. In other words, the bridge had, when he was into wind, he would flash a light, say, it's ready. And then the LSO would respond, say, okay, and the aircraft is in such place. And so there would be a sequence of control between the LSO and the bridge. This required a fair modification of things, but it turned out not too badly. I think we did, as we went along, we improved on the LSO. Jerry Moore was instrumental in that.
Right.
In doing the LSO work and the landing signals and looking after the whole deck operation. We didn't want too many people rushing out onto the platform, didn't want any out there during the landing except the LSO. And then, of course, it's most important to know that the guy is in the trap when the trap is fired, and that sort of thing.
So when you talk about some of these additions that had to have been conducted, like the lights, so that there was communication between the LSO and the bridge, was this just viewed as a stopgap measure by VX-10 so that they could get on with the actual trials?
No, this was considered very important because, as I recall, and I hope I'm right, the control of the operation was under the captain. And there was a thought that that's fine, that's where it belongs. But the captain had no way of knowing what was going on in the stern of the ship. And so we thought this was not only a requirement for VX-10 to get along, this was a requirement operationally, an essential requirement for operations, particularly when you can't be in the wind very long, and so on and so forth. And if the ship, for example, may turn into wind with the wind off the bow a bit, 15 degrees or whatever it was, but there may be too much ship movement, and the LSO may have to ask for change of speed or slight change in direction just to tend to steady the ship down.
if I remember correctly through some of the reading that I had done, the LSO was not, at that time anyhow, able to talk to both the pilot in the aircraft as well as the bridge at the same time.
And well, believe me, that was always a problem in those days. No, it shouldn't be now, but it was in those days. We could talk aircraft and LSO, but the ship would be on totally different setup and was difficult. But we did get around it. I can't quite remember what we put in, a dedicated frequency or something.
So that the communication could happen between all three.
Yeah, I think initially we probably used a phone or some damn thing, but the intent was that it would be they'd all be linked up, had to be.
Now, I'll ask this question as well. When I was reading through the material and the evaluations on some of the early trials, the position of the LSO, they went through a number of different trials to figure out
where
exactly was the best place for the LSO, not only for the LSO's own personal safety as the aircraft was coming into hover and to land on the deck, but so that he was in visual sight for the pilot, so that he could communicate with the pilot. Where did they determine was the best place for the LSO?
We actually had two positions at one time, one on each side, and the favored position, of course, was on the starboard side.
On the starboard side.
Yes, yeah, starboard side, forward out of the platform, on the platform.
And
he was down lower, because if needed, his escape net was, he was near the escape net and could get away.
Right.
And, yeah, that was it. But you see, before that, all the other signals were hand signals.
Mm-hmm.
On the other ships, when they did theirs.
Right.
This is totally different.
This was more closely resembled aircraft carrier operations?
Well, aircraft carrier operations, and we had just gone, we were using radio by that time in the aircraft, but before that it was hand signals too.
And then the new landing system for the aircraft carrier, so...
Well, they were using voice, so for the LSO.
Right, yeah, okay.
He wasn't using signals, but... So we were in the communication link was the link all the time. It's just that it had to be set up.
So these were some of the things that VX-10 was responsible for, as well as the pilots going on their conversion for the Sea Kings, and training was all part of that. What do you remember coming out of the trials with Assiniboine when she was ready to go and start following the directives that have been laid out for VX-10?
Oh boy, I remember one hell of a lot of frustration. Let's see if I can put it so it doesn't sound like I'm saying something stupid. We had a lot of frustration in trying to get our trials done. As I said, the trials had been set up methodically, and Joe was then a very professional test pilot. We went over those trials together, and we agreed what would be done in a very, very step-by-step procedure. This was hard to fit into the ship's own requirements. You know, you can't expect 200 people just to sit and wait for us to come up for maybe 20 minutes and a piece of machinery or piece of equipment go down, or a piece of instrumentation go down, and we come back and the ship's still going to sit there. They got to do something too. And then so they lay on work that they can work up their crews and what have you. And just trying to schedule this type of thing. And there were days of frustration where I can remember Joe coming in just throwing his helmet down because of this. But I'm sure the ship had the same type of
problems
and experiences. With one ship, with one aircraft, it's hard. You know, and if you have it totally dedicated, you're sure wasting a lot of people's time.
Right.
And so there was a lot of time where we had to sit down and have a drink together and try and ease over these things.
Do you remember what some of the early trials comprised that took place in Bedford Basin before Assiniboine even went to sea for the next stage of the trial?
There was a lot of very slow progress into approaching it, trying to test for turbulence. We didn't know what kind of turbulence we'd get from the ship. As you notice, we came out with a bifurcated funnel eventually because of these turbulence, but then it wasn't a real fire up. But in any event, they did. And we had that sort of thing and went on and on and on. And then there was just the slow process of hooking up. For example, when we're doing trials, early trials of lowering the probe, etc., and on the airfield, I can remember one Lawton, Naval Seaman Lawton, reaching up and grabbing probe.
Right.
And just lifted right off and landed flat on his back, with electrical shock.
Static electricity charge?
Yeah. Well, it was that sort of thing, investigating that sort of thing. Landing on, maneuvering the aircraft. About and what have you, and the problems that came up with that, of course, were fairly substantial. It took a long time, but those were the initial steps to develop the envelope.
How much could VX-10 determine about turbulence if Assiniboine is in Bedford Basin?
Just if there is wind in that.
All right.
And they would just assess it on a... If it happened to be a good windy day, then they try and get the ship in a position to they could take advantage of that and see what the turbulence might be.
Right.
Just preliminary.
Before she went to sea for
these were areas that were unknown. We didn't know. If you were hooked up and then you come down into the lee of the hangar and the funnel, etc., what happened?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was going to happen to the aircraft? We didn't know.
You raised an interesting point because it was a question that the engineers had to deal with, not from a flying perspective, I suppose, but just from a ship's engineer's perspective, was how to get this hangar on board and what to do with the funnels, and they eventually decided to split them. And you just mentioned that you weren't a great fan of that arrangement.
Well,
why do you say that?
I think the turbulence is there, whether you like it or not, and I think the trouble of bifurcating that thing, I don't think it accomplished that much. And maybe some of the pilots will say otherwise, but I don't think it did for the cost.
Right.
I think it's something you had to put up with, but it's like carrier landing. There's funnel turbulence in a carrier landing. Can't change that very much, other than adjusting in the wind.
Mm-hmm. And I don't suppose wind tunnel tests were being done at that time.
Oh, they had done wind tunnel tests. No, they had tested this thing.
Oh, had they for the funnels? I wasn't aware of that.
They had done that, and where did they do that now?
Would that have been in Ottawa, at the National Research?
It would have been done by...
Council?
Yeah, that would have been done by the construction ship...
Constructors branch?
I'm sure. I don't recall us getting involved in that. I don't think I was involved in that in any event.
So did they do many haul downs with Assiniboine lying in Bedford Basin? Did they?
They did a number. And there were good days and there were some bad days. Now, when it started then, the haul down system was a, let's see now, it was, what did we call that, space that it was, the majority of the machinery and equipment was in. It looked a bit like a Rube Goldberg design. In order to keep a constant tension,
mm-hmm.
allow the ship to move, but keep a constant tension on the wind, we're demanding an awful lot, because that movement can be fairly significant on the ship.
Right.
And you don't want the aircraft going up and down, you want it steady.
Right.
And then when the ship is steady, you want just that increase in tension to indicate we're going down. The pilot then helps it down. There were one hell of a lot of problems with that. That was a Doughty effort.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Peter Charlton was instrumental in resolving the majority of those problems for Doughty.
Poor Doughty.
Because he was on site and he has that kind of a brain.
Mm-hmm.
And an excellent design engineer. And so he was deeply involved in that, and he was changing. And Joe, the two of them, very instrumental in progressing that thing through a lot of hurdles in the haul down itself. And it was a long time before that was properly resolved. A long time.
You know, there was a number of years, I think, until all the bugs were finally worked out.
Oh, yeah.
Well after the Annapolis trials, I think.
Yeah. And then, of course, after, and Zbigniew can tell you better than anybody, the thing was simplified beautifully. And, you know, as everything is with time, but at that initially it was a cumbersome, bloody thing, and we were forever breaking cables.
Is that, I was just going to ask that, was that part of the problem with maintaining the constant tension on the wing system as well?
Yeah, and the cables would break, and we were forever changing cables, and initially it was not easy to change a cable. And then they did some work and came up with a faster way of replacing the cable, but they were breaking.
Were they not rated for that kind of tension? And
I can't remember all the problems that caused the breakage. Joe would know that, because he's the one who was so frustrated with it all. And he would know. Stretch Arnold might know, too, because Stretch was on the early part of the thing.
Do you remember, or do you have any recollection of any mishaps during these trials, and any personal injuries to any of the aircraft handlers or people working below in the machinery spaces because of the cables breaking?
I honestly can't remember one. I think we're very lucky that way, but I think we had a very careful program. And I know later they had fire in Nipigon and so on. In the period that I'm talking about, I don't think we had any, what I would say, any major kind of injury. You know, somebody may have.
As CEO of the VX-10, you've got people that are dedicated to specific tasks. They're the project officer, they're the number one test pilot, for example. And you obviously have other responsibilities, and there's a number of ongoing projects that VX-10 is responsible for. Is this one that was one of the more exciting projects that VX-10 was working on at the time?
Well, I would say it's certainly one of the most interesting, because we were in an area all of our own. We couldn't go to England, we couldn't go to the United States, or anybody else for our answer.
Right.
Went there for help, but not our answer. And as a matter of fact, they looked upon us rather askance, trying to put such a big helicopter on a small ship.
Right, the Americans were working with their drone helicopters.
Yeah, and so they were quite skeptical. And so I would say from that point of view, it was very interesting. From the other point of view, I was given people like Peter Charlton, Frank Anderson, and Joe Sosenkowski, and Stretch Arnold, and later Larry Zbigniew, another test pilot, who was trained specifically for the helicopters. He's a helicopter pilot trained specifically for helicopters. And Dave Tate, who was there as XO. I was, plus a lot of the chiefs and who were just outstanding. So I was very lucky that I could point and almost say, I need that chief. That chief, and PO or whatever it might be, for this project, and I could get him 80% of the time. Everybody wanted him, mind you, but I could get him because of this project. It was that important, and it was that interesting. So the whole phase of it was, when we look back on it, we all have our own memories of it, but I think we all sort of felt we had really accomplished something.
When Assiniboine went to see for the subsequent or follow-on components of the trials, did you have an opportunity to go along, or did you, or would you?
I went out there, and not often, because they would just go out for a day or so, and we had many, many other projects going. And but I went out in a helicopter, and we did some night work, and would that have been
with Annapolis, or would that have been with Assiniboine with the night work?
And we had a head-up display put in the helicopter to see whether this helped the pilot, and went out and we tried that. I kind of like that. But then, again, from my experience, I felt that there had to be some kind of stabilizing effort. In when you're landing aboard ship, if you can, if you have a horizon, it's extremely important. A ship can be doing all sorts of things.
Right.
But if you have the horizon,
mm-hmm.
you can keep your wings level to the horizon and let the ship do its thing, and if the ship is ready for you, you can land. In the helicopter, it's somewhat different in my opinion, that the helicopter, the ship is moving.
Mm-hmm.
It's moving four different ways. And it, when it starts to get rough, and then you've got your crosswind, and a small area, the tendency is to bring your focus in, and you don't, unless you're a really experienced pilot, get the horizon to steady yourself on. You may start, the ship's going, and when you do that, you turn.
Right,
the
okay.
The ship doesn't, you see, it rolls around an axis like this. But if the ship turns like that, and you turn like that, you're pretty soon going to separate yourself.
So that you have to go around and come back in for another approach.
Well, yeah, but if you're hooked onto a wire, you see, mm-hmm. the ship rolls five. If you were just keeping lined up with the ship and you roll like that, you're going to swing off to the side of the ship very quickly.
Because mm-hmm.
you're turning.
Right.
The ship comes back like that. When you come back like that, you're out here. So then you turn like this to come back. By this time, it's like that. And then it's here, and pretty soon you become divergent. Mm-hmm. Or can. That's the theory. It was going to my mind. And these are the things we didn't know. What we needed was a stabilized horizon on top of the hangar where the pilot is going to be most interested, because he doesn't want to get too close to that. A stabilized horizon. Well, I can recall, I think we all have slightly different views of this, but I can recall quite distinctly where, and we were sitting around just talking about it, and I said, I think we need a horizon. I had really only said just about that much. And Peter Charlton designed the thing, and Frank Anderson built it, and put it on Assiniboine.
They built it on Assiniboine, and they installed it? Or
they built it for Assiniboine.
All right.
And installed it.
Okay.
At the first one. It was Frank and Peter, and plus some chiefs and POs, to build it. That was the first one. And you know, on an aside, but somebody tried to claim prior claim credit for design of it and for some money, etc., as a patent type of thing.
Right.
Peter Charlton did it, and I can remember we have to have an artificial horizon. Yes, says Joe. We have to. And then Peter and Joe's input too, of where to put it. And so,
mm-hmm.
and so they did that. That's the kind of people they were. That's the way things were being developed.
What did you see was the problem with the, well, you said that you liked it, but I've heard that there were problems with the heads-up display that they were trying to...
Well, it was a big chunk of thing in front of you. But
I'm not a pilot, so does that mean that distracts the pilots?
People didn't like to look through
field of vision.
You look through it,
mm-hmm.
you see your ship, and at the same time, instead of looking down here for airspeed, this, that, and the other thing,
it's all
on here for you in different line. I could have got used to it quite simply, I think, but We didn't keep it.
Did they feel that it was too visually distracting or something? Took away their attention from the LSO?
I don't think there was a strong enough demand for it. I think they felt that they could do without, and they have. So it's probably just as well. But, you know, a lot of airplanes today, including commercial aircraft, go into the head-up display.
Right.
But it was in an inconvenient place when you got into the helicopter. 9 times out of 10, you're going to bang it. Same getting out, so you know you've probably got a problem on your hand if you're going to do that.
Right. Okay.
So that was one knock against it, and I just don't think it was that great an improvement for the job. And I think Joe just decided it wasn't necessary.
Was that part of the trials? Sort of an aside. It wasn't really part of the directive.
I think that was not an initial directive.
Not only.
I think that was a requirement that came in. Would a head-up, sort of like would a head-up display help? We can put one in, and I guess we put in a requirement for a head-up display. Mind you, you got to remember those were pretty early days for head-up displays, and so they weren't the nice integrated circuits and stuff and things we have now. And I think again, it was that business of being able to come up, keep your eyes focused ahead, and not in a cockpit and in a very crucial, at a crucial time. And there was no way, as I recall, of getting it out of your way when you weren't needing. In other words, just ordinary flying. It was fixed.
Right, I see. Okay.
So it didn't do the job.
Now, if I remember correctly, Assiniboine didn't really take part in any heavy weather trials for the Sea King. That was Annapolis that took over that in 1965 when Assiniboine went back in to have her hangar enlarged because it was too small. You were still there as CEO of BX-10. I heard that there was difficulty finding the heavy weather to sort of test the envelope for landing and takeoff for the Sea King. Is that accurate?
My buddy here in Victoria, Doug Ross, he took over Annapolis in January 65. He just came back from England. He had just a couple of days, and they said, here's your ship. And he took over from Bob Pierce. And he headed for just south of Yarmouth, where there was a dandy storm coming through, and they started their heavy weather drought. And they spent, I think, a month in winter, which is a good time, in heavy weather. And Jerry Watson, I believe, was piloting then. I don't think Zib was there at that time. It's a bit new. But Jerry was involved in that. They did some real heavy weather. I don't know whether they reached the envelope that we wanted to. You know, we could have gone on and on and on, but we turned it over to the operational group, and
I've read in some of the documents that you could land with up to 15 degrees of roll. I think is that does that figure sound about
right? Yeah, you got to be careful how you measure that. Now, the ship can roll 20 degrees, let's say. And you're on the wire, and you're hovering, hopefully in a steady spot, and it can go back 20. It's when it's level, you land. You're not landing that way. You're landing when the ship is level, same as you do in a carrier. Carrier is moving, pitching, whatnot, and as an LSO, it was our job to know when that steady spot would come,
the lull,
and then you land your aircraft. You capture them at that moment, and it's exactly the same with the helicopter. He might have to sit there for 30 seconds while the ship does its thing. The ship will always find its steady point at some point, and that's when the LSO and the destroyer brings it down or says land now, and he increases the tension a little, and which is the right positive movement, and the pilot helps it on down.
there's that leads to a couple of other questions. So the landing signal officer is the one that makes the decision.
He's the one watching the deck. He's key.
So I had remembered reading in some of the early trials that the RCN wanted to increase the speed at which the helicopter could be winched down, and I think the early prototype was capable of hauling down the aircraft at 10 feet per second, but VX-10 wanted it at 20 feet per second. Do you remember that?
I wouldn't say that for a helicopter. 20 feet per second is what we had for fixed wing. And we used to do our trials of equipment, etc. In fixed wing, we used to do them in Patuxent River, and because they have gear on land and what have you, and it literally is a crash landing. 9 feet per second is not very hard. It's not that very hard.